Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. All right, let's get those phones up and running to start the show this morning. You can call us 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. We had a beautiful weekend. The state has opened up again. So what do you do? What are you seeing? Do you feel comfortable getting out in public places unmasked? I'd love to hear your thoughts about getting out and about now that the state is over 80% vaccinated, the highest rate in the country, something to be really proud about. 244-1777, 877-291-8255. Father's Day yesterday, probably should have done this all last week, but if you want to honor your father, let us know about the great guy that he is or was. You can call in and tell us about him. 244-1777, 877-291-8255. Another thing I like your thoughts on is a new trend called revenge bedtime procrastination. I don't know if you've heard about this, but this is what the Boston Globe wrote about. It says it's the hottest bad habit going. Revenge bedtime procrastination. Kids on TikTok are all over it. Still thinking about the breath mints. TikTok are still all over it. So are suburban moms, Glamour magazine readers, grandparents. Here's what it is. It's when you're so desperate for time that belongs to you and only you that you stay up too late doing whatever, even though you know you're going to be exhausted tomorrow, maybe even the rest of the week. I know I've done it. I've done it to read, to surf the net, to stream. But there are times you're just so busy and you think, I just need a little time now. Of course, you wake up the next day and you're bushed and you thought, what was I doing? But I'd love to know if this is something you're doing again. 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can discuss what's ever on your mind. You can recommend a topic for future shows. I'm a little light this week right now, so I could use your help. Don't be afraid to call in. How about the videos have been released, some of the body camera videos from January 6th at the Capitol. Have you seen those? What was your reaction? Pretty intense stuff. Seeing someone wielding a flagpole and looks like swinging it at our police officers there of the Capitol Police Force. Let us know what you think on these things. 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can take us in whatever direction you'd like, and sometimes it even winds up turning into a great segment on the show. Several people have asked that we do a show about the logging on the Connecticut River, and I think I'm getting closer to finding a guest or two that we might have on the show to do that history piece, which would be really interesting. It ended, I guess, about a century ago, but really interesting stuff when that was how we got logs from our forests all the way down to Long Island Sound down the Connecticut River. But I don't know enough about it to do a show on my own. I have some guests in mind now. I've been poking around asking for people to suggest different people, and I think I'm getting close, so we might have that soon. All right, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. Get us started this week with the open phones. And, I guess I'll tell you a little bit about my father. He was not an easy guy, and I understand why. He worked in a steel mill, a machinist, for over 40 years of his life, and it is backbreaking, hard work, and I can understand that coming home from that every day could not have been easy. He lost his own father when he was just 3 years old, so raised by his mom and his brother. Off to the Navy, right out of high school, and then as soon as he got out of the Navy, right down to the steel mill in our town, and like I said, worked there for 40 years. One great thing that the steel did was every 4 years, they gave their workers 13 weeks vacation. Really quite necessary when you think about it, the work that they did, but that's a quarter of the year. And so in our town, you always knew whose father had 13 weeks. He was the guy who was getting work done, kind of like the COVID, you know. He was the guy who was able to do some work around the house. He was there to drive the kids to the pool in the summer, you know, pick us up when we had a ball game or something. And when I was 8 years old, my father had 13 weeks, and he bought a truck and a camper, and off we went from Pennsylvania to California and back for a month and got to see the country, which was a pretty special gift from him. The other thing is, when he'd get home from that steel mill, quite often he would go back out and install oil burners. He did plumbing and heating on the side, did it on weekends. He'd make me help him drag big old oil burners out of some old basements up some pretty shaky steps. And I'd have to run out to the truck to get him. He'd always ask for a monkey wrench, which I never quite learned what that was. It took, I think, 3 trips each time. I'd bring back something that wasn't a monkey wrench. I'm not sure I even know today exactly what the monkey wrench is if you sent me out to the truck. But the only thing I think I was really good for was, one, helping him drag those oil burners out. Two, probably for some companionship on a Saturday morning working on those jobs. And three, I did learn how to clean the ends of copper tubing, you know. They had to be cleaned with, like, steel wool. I think I did a decent job at that, but that was probably it. So if you want to share a little bit about your father, yesterday, Father's Day, I hope you were able to honor your father. If he's still around, you can give us a call at 244-1777, 877-291-8255. I do want to answer. Fred had a question the other day about critical race theory, and I looked it up, and I have some answers on that, and I'll save that, but give you the opportunity to call in and get things rolling here. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Many of you do take advantage of that to send in guest ideas, show topic ideas. I love that. Keep doing that. It's a big help because, you know, it's I try to give you as much local content as possible in the 2 hours that we have each day from 9 to 11 to make sure you know who's around you in Vermont, what's going on, where to go. And so I'd really like to keep it that way and keep it as fresh as possible. So don't be afraid to suggest you know, people you know in your community are doing well. If you think they'd be a great interview, or if they've got a maybe a nonprofit going that you think would be great for the rest of our listeners to hear, please let me know. You know, I have friends in this week from Ohio. They got in touch with me for weeks in advance, and people are starting to do this more and more. They're saying, "We're coming to Vermont. What should we do?" And, you know, I just had to go back to a lot of the people we've had on the show and suggest some of those things. But, you know, friends have 2 young daughters, and, you know, now I have to think, okay, what would they like to do? So, you know, you have to take out a lot of the, microbreweries that I would put on a normal list of, hey, here's what you want to do in Vermont. But I think I came up with, a pretty credible list, of where they can go. And I think they're having a great time in Vermont so far. They're here a couple days so far. All right. We do have open phones right now at 244-1777, 877-291-8255. Coming up at 9:30, John Turner will be with us. He's hosting a couple of these Vermont Veterans Town Hall meetings. We'll learn about them, which are very interesting. They'll be going on. There'll be 4 of them around the state from June through September. We'll get the details on that. At 10 o'clock, Will Rapp will tell us what his plans are for Nordic Farm in Charlotte. You know this well if you've driven down Route 7 or up Route 7, sitting there at the top of the hill. Beautiful white barn with the red, very vibrant red roof stands out there like a beacon at the top of the hill in Charlotte. He's got some agritourism ideas on how to make that a vibrant place. And then at 10:30, very important issue, we're going to talk about that women's correctional facility in South Burlington that has been problematic for years, and Bill Soule has now been given the job of figuring out what we do with it now and what we do with a new facility, which could be years down the road. So we have to get things fixed in South Burlington before we can move forward. Those are some of the things you'll hear today on the show. I'd love to hear from you at 224-1777, 877-291-8255. Now, I do want to offer an answer to our caller, Fred, from Newbury. He asked, I think on Friday, about the definition of critical race theory. And one thing he said was, it's very complicated, the answers that you're given, so people don't understand exactly what critical race theory is. It's definitely a subject being discussed around the country as states are considering incorporating this into their educational curriculum. Some states banning it from being taught in their schools. So you will hear more and more about it. It has some people angry and some confused. So I did my best to try to come up with an answer for Fred. I didn't know anything on Friday, really, and so I have not been paying attention to this particular issue. And so I did a little digging. And first of all, the clearest definition, Fred, that I found was by Encyclopedia Britannica, and this is the way they defined it. Quote, it's an intellectual movement and loosely organized framework of legal analysis based on the premise that race is not a natural, biologically grounded feature of physically distinct subgroups of human beings, but a socially constructed or culturally invented category that is used to oppress and exploit people of color. Critical race theorists hold that the law and legal institutions in the United States are inherently racist insofar as they function to create and maintain social, economic, and political inequities between whites and non-whites, especially African Americans. I think that's pretty clear as to what those who hold critical race theory are thinking. That is the clearest definition, and of course it comes from Encyclopedia Britannica. Maybe that's the best way for us to get a definition is for someone from away to look at what we're doing here. Speaking about it, Donald Trump had said, quote, students in our universities are inundated with critical race theory. This is a Marxist doctrine holding that America is a wicked and racist nation, that even young children are complicit in oppression, and that our entire society must be radically transformed. So one gives you a definition, the other gives you a critic of what critical race theory is, and you're going to hear a lot of each, I think, in the months ahead. It would teach about the 1619 Project. It would teach about the 1921 Tulsa Massacre. So there's plenty written for and against the theory, and I invite you to research it further. Make your own decisions. I will tell you that it, again, like so much we run into these days, is pretty much divided along ideological lines. So you can, again, do your research, find out what you think about it. And we do have Fred in Newbury. Fred, go right ahead.
Good morning.
Morning.
I got another good one for you.
All right.
You know, the riot at the Capitol, you know what I'm talking about?
January 6th?
Yeah, that's right, January 6th. Here's an interesting phenomenon right here. They say there's 40 or so unindicted co-conspirators. That sounds interesting, doesn't it?
Say that again, Fred.
And nobody knows who they are, I guess. And then the other interesting thing is, all the communication that these people, these rioters, were using was unencrypted, and it was in an open, they call it open mic communications. I can't remember what they were using for an app to communicate. It's something you can get on the internet. That thing. But anyways, it looks like that the FBI was sound asleep, or the NSA was sound asleep because they're supposed to monitor all kinds of electronic information.
Yeah, Fred, I think you're going to find that 100% of America agrees with you on that. You know, no matter where you're from, you know, on whatever side, whether you agree with what happened that day or disagree, the preparation seemed woeful. And, you know, as we saw that group march from the White House to the Capitol, you know, and you... You remember it well. It's kind of ingrained now in your memory, probably forever, to see just some bike racks and a few Capitol Hill police officers standing there. It was a scary a picture because at first, you know, if the protesters had gotten to that line of bike racks and stopped and just shouted and protested, that would have been one thing, but they advanced. They moved through, tore them down pretty quickly, and stormed the Capitol. And so you're right. If that information was out there, so easily accessible to, you know, our security, why wasn't there more of a presence at the Capitol that day to just kind of quell it? I agree, Fred.
Yeah. It's unbelievable.
It is unbelievable.
Exactly unbelievable. So you begin to wonder, who are these co-conspirators? Were they provocateurs that are employed with the government?
I'll let you noodle around with that one. I've got no answer. All I just look at it and say, we did a poor job of preparing for what it seemed like we knew what was coming. Fred, thanks so much. Keep things over there well in the Duchy of Newbury. All right. We still have a few minutes for open phones, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. I don't know if you've seen the video, the body camera footage that's now been released. So the Associated Press did sue to have that release, and it has been released. And, boy, the more times you see footage from any angle, but this is from the police officers, you know, and there they are trying to do their best, undermanned. As Fred said, you know, how is that even possible? When so much of what was going on, communications ahead, the plans were available for everyone to know about. And there they are, just a very thin blue line that day, having to stand there as this mass started to march upon them. And they had to, you know, trust human nature that people would stop, people would respect that they are police officers, would respect that, you know, this is the institution of the Congress and Senate of the United States, and they didn't. They ignored that. And you see people swinging things at police officers, and that makes, that just, it frightens me that they did not honor our police officers that day. All right, let's get a quick one in from Middlesex. Ron, we only have about a minute. Go right ahead.
All right, quick one. When I was in the early 40s, I'm 80 years old, so that goes back. My father and I were rail fans, and we used to go up in New York State to a place called Harmon, where they used to change from electric engines to steam engines. And we would hang out on a Saturday and watch them make the change. This big, one of the big steam, New York Central main trains was, just had their steam engine hooked up. And my father put me up on his shoulder so I could see the engineer open the throttle. And we were at the back of the, at the engineer's cab. And these engines, for people that don't know, steam engines, these big ones have a boost engine under the, rear trucks.
Hey, Ron, I'm going to ask you to hold that story. I want you to call back. I think we're going to have an open phone tomorrow. Call early. I want to hear this. I'm a big rail fan. I want to hear from you again, Ron, but we got to go to a break. Oh, so sorry. But please call in earlier tomorrow when we have open phones, and we'll hear the full story. I'm excited to hear it. I want to know all about it. Thanks for calling, Ron, and I apologize. We're going to take a break, and when we return, John Turner will join us to talk about the Vermont Veterans Town Hall meetings. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. Now we're going to learn about the Vermont Veterans Town Hall meetings. They were first held in the state in 2017. This year, one will be held each month now through September. Joining us to share information about them and what happens at one of those meetings is John Turner. John is a Marine veteran. He operates Wild Roots Community Farm in Bristol, and he will serve as host of two of these town hall meetings. John, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi, Rick. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's great having you. Listeners, if you've got a question for John, or if you've attended one of the Veteran Town Hall meetings in the past and would like to share your experience, you can give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. John, give us a general idea of what takes place at one of these town hall meetings.
Yeah, so typically what happens is, after everyone gathers in, we invite veterans to come up and tell a story. It doesn't have to be a story specific about their time in service or their time in combat. It could be about their transitional process afterwards. It can be really anything that has meaning that did essentially root from their time in service, but it doesn't specifically have to be about it. And so we've had people come up and talk about how they were nurses during times of conflict and how that translated to their life's experience now. And really it's just an opportunity for the veteran community to talk about something that has meaning that they feel is important for others to know about.
John, where did this idea of Veterans Town Hall meeting originally come from?
Sebastian Younger, he was an embedded reporter in Afghanistan with the 173rd Airborne Division. And He noticed that there is a certain camaraderie that came to exist with people who survived through traumatic experiences or very enduring conditions. And he had spent some other time in other war zones throughout the world, but I think this is the one that really got to him because it was American soldiers who were undergoing these extreme circumstances. And he ended up documenting this all and released Korngal and then Restrepo. Korngal can be found on Netflix if anyone's interested in seeing it. But then he worked with Massachusetts Representative Seth Moulton to create this town hall event, which allows a veteran to come and to share a part of their life experience, like I said, either in, after, or combat or military service.
Vermont held its first in 2017. Why was it important for Vermont's veterans to have a venue of this sort, John?
I think, we've been in Iraq and Afghanistan since 2001. We've had around 3 million troops cycle in and out of these two countries. Many of them have been on multiple deployments. And so that's a very large population that has varied experiences overseas, or in military service for that matter. And unfortunately, it's too common that when servicemen and women get out, they kind of are lacking a purpose, for better or worse terms. And because of that, they can either fall into a pretty deep spiral, and which too many people, kind of fall into,
or they can push forward and find meaning again. And so I think that the reason this was so important was in Vermont is because the Vermont Guard has been on multiple deployments, and there's just really not an outlet for the veteran community to come together in a public setting to share their experience and to kind of break down the stigma that has occurred in the past between the veteran and the non-veteran communities.
Let's get specific about what happens at the meetings. You've given us kind of an overview, but who can speak and for how long?
Any veteran is welcome to speak. It doesn't matter when you served. It doesn't matter where you served. It doesn't matter what your service was like. If you have a story to tell, please come and tell your story. We've had folks that have kind of entered into the space not expecting to say anything, and when it's all said and done, the people who have registered are done speaking. We allow audience members to come up who were veterans to kind of share their story if they're willing to, and oftentimes we have a good number of folks that do come up, and sometimes it's stories that they've held on to for 40 years that they've never told anyone, and they're willing in that moment to share that experience, which is incredibly heartwarming. And then you have folks who just kind of stay in the audience and they keep quiet, and that's okay. You know, there's no judgment. There's no politics behind the stories. It's just a means for the vet community to talk about what they feel.
How long do the town hall meetings last, John?
A couple hours. And so, I believe this one is scheduled, I should know this, between 1 and 4. At Camp Mead over in Middlesex behind Red Hen Bakery. But what we've done, what was it, 2 years ago, what we did was, after it was all said and done, we had the town hall meeting. We opened it up to a Q&A panel. And that allows participants to kind of go a little bit further into some of their stories or to allow the audience to ask further questions. And it was really incredible when we did that at St. Mike's 2 years ago because, you know, we were uncertain as to what the participation would be with the audience after the fact. But probably 2/3 of the folks stayed around specifically for this. And we ended up having this incredible conversation with 5 panelists and all these audience members for an additional hour and a half. And that was one of the kind of like unexpected moments that occurred that I think was just as, if not more, impactful because we were able to dive a little bit deeper into what was said or what wasn't said.
Yeah, do these talks get emotional, somewhat cathartic?
Absolutely. There's a Vietnam vet who I had met probably about 5 years ago, and he showed up for the first one, and he talked about one of his experiences that he had with frag grenades. And I had heard this story before, and this was only the second time he was sharing it. And you can tell that the audience was being impacted by it. And it's not, the purpose of us telling these stories isn't to receive pity from anyone by any means.
Right.
It's because there's a burden that the veteran community carries, that others might not know about. And it's not to say that our trauma is any more explicit or important than other people's trauma. But going back to, you know, the amount of people who have served, in and out of combat zones and kind of the shared experience and the shared trauma that we have, you know, it is an important thing to talk about it. And like I said, it's not about, you know, receiving pity or any kind of pat on the back. It's just because we want our community, which includes the non-veteran community, to push forward and to be resilient. And one of the best ways we can do that is by sharing our experience so we can learn from our past and move forward with grace.
John, I know that it's military veterans who speak that day, but who can attend the meetings?
Anyone. If you're interested in hearing some stories, anyone is welcome to attend.
And, you know, why do you think it's important for non-military personnel, people who haven't served in particular, to take the opportunity to attend these town hall meetings?
I got out in 2007 after serving a few deployments overseas and began to travel around the country with some other veterans, kind of helping with that reintegration process. And one of the common themes among the non-veteran community is, well, what can I do to help? And that answer has varied greatly over the years. I'm kind of leaning along the lines of saying that all you have to do is just listen, and kind of, you know, respond in an appropriate manner. And I think that it's really great when people who don't have any experience with war attend, and they come up to you afterwards and be like, I had no idea. Thank you. You know, this is what I do. I would love to be able to offer my services. Or you have folks that come up and say, my dad went through, a lot of emotional things when we were kids and I didn't understand it, but now I do. Thank you. And so it's, you have all of these different responses and reactions to the event, and every time, you know, it is very emotional, and not in an unhealthy manner. You know, some of the stories certainly are traumatic, but for the most part, I think it's just really this beautiful experience that occurs, and this kind of cohesion between the veteran and non-veteran community that exists afterwards.
John, is there a specific theme for each meeting, or are they open-ended for each speaker to decide on where they'll go during their 10 minutes?
No, it's entirely open-ended. We try not to limit the speaker by any means. There's definitely been folks in the past who were, you know, uncertain as to what they could or should talk about, and normally just, you know, kind of go over the you know, the parameters of it, and that there's, you know, it's not about anything specific, and they usually kind of find their own path and tell an incredible story.
What are some of the various wars that you've had represented by the soldiers who have gotten up and spoken?
There's been a large number of from our recent conflict in the global war on terror in Iraq and Afghanistan. We've had some Vietnam veterans come up. We've had some Cold War veterans come up. There's been a couple veterans from Kosovo. It's kind of wide range. I would love to get some of the World War II vets, you know, that are in the area up, just because I think they have incredible stories to tell, and to actually get some more, you know, if possible, Korean War vets or Vietnam vets. I feel like their stories, you know, are really only depicted in motion pictures, and it's much more than that. And, you know, as this generation, you know, is respectfully getting older, I feel like these are the stories that we need to hear and to learn from in order to move forward, so hopefully we don't make the same mistakes with our future generation of warfighter.
There's going to be four of these town hall meetings, and John, I hope you don't mind. I'll give the dates and locations. June 27th in Middlesex, July 18th in Newport, the August 8th in Rutland, and then September 19th in Burlington. And again, vtvetstownhall.org is where you can find that information. John, what you're going to host two of them. I think you've got Middlesex and Burlington. What's your role as host of this?
Kind of just make sure things move along. It's really about doing an overview of the process of the history of the town hall, to kind of lay down some of the guidelines and expectations from both participants and the audience. And then just to really, you know, do a brief introduction, for the folks that are willing to come up and talk about their experience, and just to make sure, you know, the schedule keeps pushing forward, with respect to time and, but also respect to the stories that are being shared.
Do people have to register to attend and or to speak at the meeting?
Yes and no. So we do hope for registration, pre-registration online, just so that we can have a decent idea of what the numbers are looking like moving forward, and that just allows us to, you know, other ends of the logistics spectrum. But if people show up, and they are welcome to register right there on site. If they want to speak, like I said previously, you know, even if they weren't registered to speak and they show up that day, and then all of a sudden, you know, it's closing hour, and they feel inclined to tell a story, we're not going to turn them away. We want everyone to feel as though their voice is being heard, and that the audience can take away something good from it.
Will this all be in person? Any of it virtual? Are there any protocols in place?
We are all in person, which I'm really looking forward to, and I'm sure most others are as well.
Of course.
So, you know, with the reduction of restrictions in the state of Vermont, you know, I think the big thing is just be smart about, you know, your attendance. If you're sick, don't go. If you feel as though you want to wear a mask, still go ahead. But we will be in person following the guidelines from the state of Vermont that have been put forth most recent, and we hope to see people there.
Can someone attend or speak at more than one of these town hall meetings?
Absolutely. Of course, you know, as we go to new locations, we want to try to get the folks up there who haven't had the opportunity to speak previously first. But sometimes it takes, you know, someone who's done this a couple times to get up there and kind of lay down a good foundation for the speakers who will precede them. But we encourage folks to come one, multiple times, whatever they feel fit to do.
What kind of donations and volunteer help are needed for these meetings, John?
I think a lot of that information can be found on the website. Kristen Eaton, she's been working with Sebastian Younger over the last couple of years to make this happen and has really worked tirelessly, mostly solo doing this. And so that's a huge undertaking that she has committed herself to. And so I think any way to help her with the marketing, the public relations, and kind of getting the word out there is really good. And her contact information is on the Vermont Veterans Town Hall website. She would be the best person to talk to figure out where more efforts should be placed.
Do you mind telling us about your time in the Marines?
Yeah, sure. So I've had a family member in every conflict going back to the Revolutionary War. And so between my junior and senior year of high school, I asked my mother to sign off on me entering the delayed entry program with the Marine Corps, and she did so. And so a month and a half after I graduated high school, I was off in boot camp in Parris Island, went through 3 months of that, 2.5 months of infantry training, and then I got to my unit in February of 2004, and 2.5 weeks later, we were deployed to Haiti. So within a 2.5 year period, my unit deployed three times, and by the time I got out, you know, I'd seen combat, lost some buddies, and it was a difficult transition coming out of the military world at during the height of the Iraq War. And then transition into a society that really didn't have a full comprehensive understanding as to what young men and women were experiencing in combat or in military service during that period of time. And so I think that a lot of my efforts since then have been to assist with the reintegration process as best as possible, so that way we don't continue to make another statistic with another veteran committing suicide because they didn't have the support network in place that they needed to assist with that transitional process.
And one of those ways... Yeah, we only have about 45 seconds, but is the Farmer Veterans Coalition. Can you just tell us a little bit about that?
So the Farmer Veteran Coalition began in, I think, 2006 or 2007 as a means to assist the veteran population to transition into agriculture to help them find a new purpose or mission in their life after military service or even while they're in. And so back in 2015, after working to build the momentum in the New England region. I had become the founding chair of the organization and stayed on that for a little while until stepping away to focus more on working with, you know, college students and high school students in my own area. Still work with the veteran population. I love it. I am one, and they are very near and dear to my heart, and I want to see them succeed as much as possible. But I have not been engaged with that chapter, the state chapter, for a couple of years now. But I would still encourage folks who are interested in agriculture to check out the farmvetco.org website. There's a lot of good information and resources available to veterans who are interested in farming or currently have an operation running.
All right. Thanks, John. John Turner is, John is currently operating Wild Roots Community Farm in Bristol. He's going to host the Veterans Town Hall meetings in Middlesex and Burlington. And to learn more about all four meetings, go to vtvetstownhall.org. John, thank you for your service. Thanks for being with us this morning.
Hey, thanks, Rick. I appreciate it.
All right, take care. We're going to take a break for CBS News, and then we're going to return to learn about what plans are in store for the Nordic Farm in Charlotte. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. As you head south on Route 7 in Charlotte, atop a rise, you'll spot a very distinct Vermont farm. Stark white walls are topped by a stunning red roof. It has a quintessential Vermont look to it. Before it closed, Nordic Farm was a dairy farm that had converted to New England's first robotic milking machines. But the farm declared bankruptcy in 2017. Since then, there have been some interesting things going on there involving shrimp and malt. Now there are bigger plans for that big farm up on the hill. Here to share them is Will Rapp, the new owner of Nordic Farm. Will, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Good. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's great having you. Listeners, if you've got a question for Will Rapp about his plans for Nordic Farm, you can give us a call, 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Will, first of all, tell us about the farm and property there at Nordic.
Okay. The farm is about almost 600 acres, actually 583 acres. It's all conserved, which means it has conservation easements that control any ability to develop it. There is a 15-acre farmstead conservation easement that allows certain kinds of agricultural development to happen and agricultural accessory development to happen, which is where the farm buildings and barns are now. We're actually just researching the history of the barn, of the farm overall. It seems to be, going back hundreds of years, probably very much consistent with what happened in Champlain Valley over time, where there was grain farming 150 years ago and sheep farming. And when those agricultural practices declined in Vermont, that's when the dairy business came in, probably 100, 120 years ago. And it thrives through the 20th century until the whole dairy industry began to be stressed with other competitive products and with the West becoming a lower-cost producer, et cetera. So what's happening in Vermont is, you know, when I got here, there were 7,000 farms and now, dairy farms, and now there's just a little over 600. It's a consolidation of that. So the dairy farms are getting bigger, but a big farm like Nordic is no longer cost-effective to operate. And people who are aggregating dairy farms are too far away for this to become an add-on farm. Mm. So when you have a farm like this that has conservation easements on it, it has very little options going forward except to be a farm. So then what do? To figure out the best kind of farming? You have to think about how to use its location, its soil type, its existing infrastructure, the restrictions on the conservation easements to figure out how to make something that can cover the costs. And the big cost for Nordic is, in fact, its bank debt. So over time, it has accumulated a fair amount of bank debt, and we're going to be adding to that in the purchase price. So to figure out how to cover the bank debt, it's really not just one dairy business that you need to do, like maybe in the past, it's multiple businesses. Our focus is really the renovation and redevelopment of the grain industry in Champlain Valley. Not as the breadbasket of New England like it was 150 years ago, but much more as specialty grains in service to bakery flour, in service to malt for brewing and for distilling, and in service to local food needs. So the process of doing that is really what Vermont has to do in agricultural overall, which is figuring out how to do value-added farming, because we can't really succeed as a commodity agricultural state. We win when we look at how to use our working landscape to produce products that we can get better margins on and that can carry the Vermont brand. And that's what we're doing at Nordic. In the grain realm, in the botanicals realm, in the Barry realm, and in generally the whole regeneration focus of farming, where tired soils are brought back to health, and we basically can envision a more productive working landscape.
Well, Will, I mentioned it closed as a dairy farm in 2017, but there has been some activity there at Nordic Farm since then. So what has been going on?
Yeah, good question. So in 2003, a 44,000 square foot robotics open air, but still very good structure, metal structure, robotics milking barn was built within the conservation easement process. And that building in 2008 and 2009 was renovated into a malt house. And there was a small malt house in Moncton that worked with a group of investors to buy the farm and to relaunch the malt house. Unfortunately, when they finally finished the renovation of that building, COVID had just hit, and the challenge of expanding a small business, doing sales calls, engaging with growers, engaging with malt buyers, which would be really more the brewery and distillery side of things, starting a new flour mill, et cetera, was just really bad timing. And what we took on was, how can this malt business be not the main business, but a business? Because, frankly, the cost of a 600-acre dairy carrying a lot of debt can't be supported. It was supported by a dairy operation in the past. With dairy, you get to milk every day, and you have cash flow every day. With malt, it's not quite the same. It's a growing industry. It's an industry that has to adapt to market conditions. And we think that that malt operation, which will still operate there, mm-hmm. Will maybe cover a quarter or maybe a third of the overhead costs. So what you need is other business practices, other business developed to support what is happening on that working landscape beyond the malting side of things.
And that idea is a plan that's being referred to as Nordic 3.0.
Right.
Yeah, so it's that, I guess the idea is that it will be an agribusiness hub. So first of all, what does that mean, an agribusiness hub?
Well, so I spent 35 years participating in the development of an agribusiness hub, if you will, at the Intervale in Burlington, the Intervale Center in Burlington. What that ended up being was an incubator for a dozen farms, a composting operation, the largest now native plant riparian nursery in Vermont, a food hub, which is now joining with three or four other food hubs to become a statewide collaborative food hub. And all that was under the auspices of the Intervale Center, a nonprofit organization that helps to coordinate access to those 300 acres of land so we could have new farmers farming that land in, you know, being supported by cooperatively accessed irrigation and greenhouses and refrigeration and food hub market access, et cetera. So that's the example. That's an example of a agricultural business incubator. It's just like other business incubators. In this case, it's more on the farming side of things. What we have to do is take a step back and look at what the assets are at Nordic, just like we did 35 years ago in the Intervale, and look at how to piece those assets together into a program that can allow individual farmers to succeed as part of an ecosystem of farmers. So that's what we're trying to do at Nordic. There will be, like the Intervale Center, a central entity, probably two central entities, actually. One would be a nonprofit organization, and the other one would be a for-profit organization, which we call, or at least a organization that is structured as an LLC, which would be called Nordic 3.0. We don't have a name for the nonprofit yet, but the nonprofit would essentially be the, have the focus of taking that iconic 100-plus-year-old barn on the hill and the several acres around it and converting it into more of an education center, demonstration place, ecotourism, agricultural tourism hub, etc. It's going to take several million dollars to renovate that barn. You could never raise the money in a capital access like with banking and investor standpoint. You're going to have to do it with grants and philanthropy, you know, historic preservation grants, economic development grants, etc. So this is a complex organization effort to basically take a big, well-located farm that has lots of debt on it, but also has lots of opportunities to be an innovator into the future, like it was in the past, and try and figure out how to access the resources to unlock the potential.
Will, how far have plans gone to attract other agribusinesses to the grounds of Nordic Farm?
Well, you know, we just sort of went public a couple weeks ago with what our plans are. And to be honest, we haven't even closed on the farm yet because we're doing final negotiations with our bank and with the current owners. And so we can't make a whole lot of commitments yet.
Right.
We do have sort of hubs of activity. So one hub is what we call the Vermont Grain Co-op, and that is the malting operation. That is a bakery that's in there now, Slow Fire Bakery. That is an aquaculture operation that's in there now doing shrimp. That is Foam Brewery, which is aging beer and putting beer into bottles of specialty beer that they produce. We have had conversations with Nitty Gritty Grain, which is a 25-year-old Shalott-based organic grain and flour company, that they would come in and use the flour mill that we have there and the silo that we have there to do grain milling as an additional business that would be there. We are in discussions with Whistle Pig Distillery. They have really high quality whiskey, and they will be launching in a couple months a single malt brand of whiskey, which basically, I discovered this, means that the malt is not, or that the whiskey is not a blended source of whiskey. It's all coming from one malt house and distillery, and Nordic would be the malt house and distillery. So over time, a key new business at the malt or at the grain operation would be Whistle Pig. We'd be growing rye for them in the fields of Nordic. We'd be malting it, and ultimately they would be distilling it. They would have a tasting room there, etc. Another hub is an energy, what we call Farm Energy Innovation Center. Nordic is really interesting in that it has currently a 550 kilowatt solar array on the roof of the malt house barn. It's almost an acre big array. But they also have the first anaerobic digester using manure inputs. This was almost 20 years ago, to generate electricity from methane digestion. From manure digestion, the creation of methane. And we're working with Green Mountain Power on the idea of reactivating that that anaerobic digester. So with those two things, you'd almost have a megawatt of power. But more important than that is the new innovations in the last two decades around battery storage and microgrid optimization. So how can you take all the various functions that might happen at Nordic in terms of the demand for electricity and figure out how the solar and the anaerobic digestion could be optimized so that you are servicing those businesses with renewable energy, and any excess renewable energy can go back into the grid. The Green Mountain Power is really highly committed to figuring out how farms can become what they really are, which is sort of a source of solar energy in the bigger sense, photosynthesis sense, but also a source of renewable energy that could help power the farm and help power the grid. Third would be a botanic hub where we have a company called Crea Botanical, which is the largest extractor of hemp for CBD, as well as other botanicals. They're operating in South Burlington now. They would move into a new building that we would build that would grow botanicals and hemp at Nordic and process them there. Another brand called Upstate Elevator is a CBD brand that would work with Nordic to grow and with Crea Botanicals to extract. So they would have a local Vermont source of organic hemp and botanicals for what they need. So part of this is just trying to figure out how you engage businesses that can be collaborative and work together to raise all of their needs and serve all of their needs. There's another business called Shrubly, which is a three-year-old Vermont business out of Hinesburg that uses aronia to make apple cider-based craft soda. They need 5 acres of aronia. We would grow 5 acres of aronia there, ideally located within a new ground-mounted solar array. So you're integrating agriculture and renewable energy. They would then also be part of this botanical hub where you're looking for adding crops to Nordic that can become profitable as you also are providing inputs to the businesses that are partnering there. On the hub that would be the barn, the old barn that would be renovated, that's where it gets really exciting, I think. We've had a oven-fired pizza company come to us and say, gee, do you have room for growing, for us to produce pizza? We're talking about opening up a farm market there so they could be a player there. We're really looking at, if you look at that barn, it's got an amazing hayloft, 10,000 square feet, 30 feet high, and it's like a cathedral inside. Mm-hmm. How could it become a museum for what's happened over 1,000 years in terms of food production and working landscape in Champlain Valley? Going back to the Abenakis, including Cyrus Pringle, who was a Charlotte native, who was one of the leading innovators in the U.S. 150 years ago around plant genetics, including barley and wheat varieties, but also moving up into present day where the dairy industry is transitioning into a new diversified industry of farming, is then transitioning also into how we regenerate the soils and whatnot. An education center, we were contacted by the leader of the UVM Medical Center Nutritional Program, who was asked, could there be a school that looks at how to do healthy cooking? So classes for healthy cooking, a commercial kitchen for healthy cooking, again, using inputs from the farm. In this case, if it was a nonprofit, the hayloft could be the museum, the cooking school, event space, et cetera. And then the lower part where they did all the milking before, that could be, we've been contacted by a coffee house. What about putting a coffee location in there? So mm-hmm. If people were to come as they drive down Route 7 and stop for a cup of coffee and a croissant that we would make there, they could also look at other local vendors. We like the idea of bringing in multiple Vermont NGOs. I'm talking, Vermont Land Trust, Vermont Natural, Conservation Resources, the NRC, Intervale Center, NOFA, where we're creating really a meld, a mind meld of the innovation that's happening on Vermont landscapes because of these leading NGOs showing the way. They are all typically hidden, and we'd like to make them revealed.
when Nordic 3.0 is fully functioning, how many businesses and employees do you see there on the grounds?
Honestly, I could have never guessed that the Intervale would have had probably 50 employees and 15 businesses 35 years ago. But more importantly, is the thousands of jobs in Vermont overall that have been impacted by, you know, the composting, the riparian nursery, the food hub, the local food movement that the Intervale Center has been part of. So what I really see is Nordic being a catalyst for a new grain industry, for a new botanicals industry, for agritourism at a higher level where we can put together NGOs and businesses. So the answer to your question is maybe like the Intervale, 50 employees, 15 businesses, I don't know for sure.
Mm-hmm. Which could create a lot of...
That you need a bunch of businesses to cover the overheads structure of the farm.
This certainly could create a lot of traffic on a busy two-lane state road. So have you given thoughts on how that would be handled?
Great question. And that's one of the two or three biggest challenges or questions or obstacles or opportunities, depending on how you want to frame it.
Mm-hmm.
It is a busy state road, but it already is a very busy state road. And what we would need to do is have a very safe entrance and exit process, which would probably require a third turning lane there as we look at the potential for more visitors. It has got good visibility in both directions from a safety standpoint, but I suspect V-Trans and Charlotte Town and whatnot are going to be contributing their good thinking to how we would really make sure that if we have the kind of traffic that, say, Teddy Bear has a half mile to the north of this location, we make sure that the access and egress are safe.
Will, we only have a minute left. Want to get an idea of the timeline to get this started and possibly completing it?
Great question. We're going to open a farmer's market in August where the majority of the products will come off of the farm. So that will be the first visible step we're going to take. The malt house, we hope, will go back into operation next month. Whistle Pig, we hope, will begin to move in with both malting for them and with a tasting room in the next 6 months. There are currently occupants, you know, the bakery, the aquaculture operation, et cetera, that are already operating right now. Over the course of the next year, we hope we can launch the renovation of the big barn with, you know, the nonprofit being formed to do that.
Will Rapp founded Gardener's Supply in the Intervale Center. He's now owner of Nordic Farm on Route 7 in Charlotte. To learn more about his plans, you can visit nordicfarmvt.org. Will, thank you so much for being on the program this morning.
Thank you for hosting me. Appreciate
sure thing. It. Take care. Red Sox, a well-deserved day off. They get back at it in St. Petersburg tomorrow night against the Tampa Bay Rays. WDEV coverage begins at 6:10. First pitch from the Trop tomorrow is 7:10. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. One of those important and knotty issues we face in Vermont is that of corrections. Right now, specifically, how to make sure that the women in Vermont's correctional system are housed in a facility that provides adequate, safe and clean facilities that meet all of their needs. Vermont's only in-state women's correctional facility is in South Burlington, and it has its share of problems. Here to discuss those and to share his thoughts on what the state can do to improve the system for women who are incarcerated is Bill Soule. Bill is the project manager for the Vermont Department of Corrections. Bill, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Good morning.
Good morning. Listeners, if you have a question or comment about the Chittenden Regional Correctional Facility in South Burlington, you can join us by calling 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. Bill, you've been part of corrections for a long time, so give us a little overview of your time with the DOC.
Sure. Thanks, Rick. Yeah, I worked for the department for about 40 years now. I actually started out as a entry-level correctional officer back at the old Woodstock Correctional Facility, which is now long closed. I worked there for about 4 years and then left to go into the field as a probation and parole officer, and enjoyed that experience for a number of years, but always had my heart into the correctional facility. So I returned to the Southeast State Correctional Facility around 1993, I believe, and worked there, became the assistant superintendent, and later the superintendent of that facility when Mike Coxon, who had been there for over 30 years, had finally retired. So in 2001, I took over the facility. 2003, Governor Douglas announced that the facility was going to be transitioning into a women's facility, and that's really where I became more involved in women in corrections. And I remained in that capacity until the fall of 2006, at which point I returned to the field as the district manager of the Hartford Probation and Parole Office.
Bill, 40 years, that's a long time in a department that's not easy for people to stay in for that long. To what do you owe that longevity?
I started young. and at the time when I started in the business, corrections just offered a great opportunity for around training and just, I think when – over the years, these positions, they go up and down depending on how the economy is and how the job market is. And, for example, right now we're really struggling to find correctional officers. Right. But over the longevity of the career, it's a great run because, you can work in other forms of employment in the state and face that, 100-person layoff after 10 or 15 years. And certainly a career with the Department of Corrections has the potential to be long-lasting. And I think the big thing for me is it really provides an opportunity to jump in and learn. I've really enjoyed every aspect of the different roles I have, which is why I continue to work in this field, because you're always learning. It's very challenging and it's very rewarding.
Before you were asked to take on this particular position, which is project manager for the women's facility, what was your role at DOC?
I was the district manager at the Hartford Probation and Parole Office.
And is that one you'll probably return to after you're finished with this?
Yes.
So what exactly was your charge for this project from Commissioner Baker?
Essentially, the Downs, we can start from the very beginning. The 7 days report, which came out in December 4th of 2019, so that was 19 months ago. And from the day of that report coming out, a lot of people from the department have put a lot of effort and time into improving the overall conditions of the Chittenden facility. And the Downs Redfield Martin report came out about a year later because of the COVID. But when the recommendations came from that report, again, a number of people had already been well-versed and working on a number of the projects, but they needed someone to sort of coordinate or oversee the project to keep it moving. And that's where I came involved.
That report from Downs Racklin Martin, what are some of the things that they concluded that you agree with and your reaction to the report overall?
I thought the report was spot on. I mean, they came up with 17 recommendations. I was removed from the women's facility involvement from the women's facility for a number of years. So, you know, I was certainly shocked with what had happened. But it really, you know, got me thinking about how the women, the problem in Vermont, which is not different from a lot of states, is most of the incarcerated people are men, and that certainly holds true in Vermont, where we have a headcount of around 85. So I think often the women are an afterthought in the process. And if you look at a lot of our practices, they're really geared towards men. If you look at the women, they started out at Chittenden a number of years ago. They expanded to a Dale facility, which is part of the state hospital in Waterbury. And then in, you know, Governor Douglas moved them all to Windsor as really the first women's prison. And then shortly after I left, a couple of years after I left, they then moved them to St. Albans and then moved them back to Chittenden. So they've really been bounced around throughout the system without really a solid plan. And that's, you know, that certainly has contributed to a lot of the problems. And as we stand now, they're, you know, the women are incarcerated in really a facility that was designated for, it was a men's detention facility. So that certainly in itself has created a lot of challenges.
Well, Bill, as you mentioned, you served as women's prison superintendent in Windsor. What did you learn in that position that helps you in what you're working on now?
Well, I was fortunate to be surrounded by some really good people. I went to the National Institute of Corrections and attended a training for new wardens of a women's facility and established some great contacts across the country. And some of those contacts I've continued with today. There's just a number of great advocacy groups in Vermont that really rallied behind the Windsor facility, and some of those groups still exist today. And that's been great. And I think the big difference for me is we have to recognize that, you know, everybody wants to be, we want to treat everybody fairly, but clearly how we treat men and women in the system should be very different because they certainly are different.
What were some of the things you were able to do at Windsor that aren't being done at Chittenden right now?
Well, we were fortunate at Windsor in that we were, you know, we had it was a very large facility. We started out, I think initially when the women arrived, the concept was they were just going to pick up the ball where the men were and continue with the programming. And we really made a shift from that. You know, for example, we, you know, we used to split wood and burn all the wood in a big wood boiler. And when the women arrived, that just wasn't appropriate. So we shifted that out. We were making license plates and things like that, but they weren't really meaningful trades that were going to help the women. So Vermont Works for Women, they were huge and they're still huge today, but they came in and really took some of the programs we had to the next level. We were doing Habits for Humanity homes. We actually built two homes on the grounds from the wiring and plumbing right up through and moved them out into the community. And it really gave the women an opportunity to learn some non-traditional jobs and really sharpen their skills so when they get out into the community, they could earn a more livable wage. We also had a great vocational educational program. We were able to do some really humane visiting with children, which is such a huge factor with the women's population. Just the whole environment down there was a much better setting. You know, there was more space. The women were outside more. There was gardens. We had a dog there that was, you know, that walked around. That was part of the culture. It was just, I think it just really bred success.
And is Windsor closed now? I think it closed a few years ago. Am I right about that?
Oops, Bill, we had a little break.
Oh,
I'm sorry.
Is Windsor? Did we close the Windsor prison recently?
Yes, that facility's been closed for a couple of years now.
So, is there any possibility. I know one of the reasons that the women were moved to Chittenden County was proximity to their families. But is there any thought that reestablishing what you had at Windsor at one time would be the right move for the women who are incarcerated in Vermont?
Well, that's certainly a good question. The state still owns the land. There's been, you know, there was legislative language or discussion around possibly selling the land, but that land still exists. And I think as we move forward and we consider a new site for a women's facility or a reentry facility, you know, there's only so much land in Vermont.
Right.
So I think that certainly would be considered.
Bill, there's been a litany of problems at the Chittenden facility being reported as far back as 2012. First of all, why have these problems persisted?
Well, I think certainly working in a women's facility in somewhat of a male-dominated culture it brings on its challenges in itself, and I think that the way the if you think about it, the women were moved from Windsor to St. Albans, so you're moving, you know, we had a pretty extensive training program at Windsor before the women arrived, and we were actually fortunate to be able to close the facility for a couple of weeks and prepare for that move. And, you know, moving them to St. Albans to a different culture where you have a number of staff who have worked with men only, was challenging, and then moving them again to Chittenden. I think a big piece of that is just not having really good training around that, and that's stuff that we've really taken a look at since I've been in this role. We're really trying to take a deep dive into the culture and look at some things we can do to make some changes. For example, we've built a really strong management team now. We've hired two new assistant superintendents, John Turek and Desiree Crump. We have a new interim security and operations supervisor, which are, you know, really key positions to the facility. You know, your management team is really the backbone to strengthening the rest of your organization. And we are really in the in the middle of pulling off a major training through the National Institute of Corrections, which I'd be glad to elaborate on further.
Sure, I'd be happy to hear that.
Okay. So the National Institute of Corrections has had this training program out there for about 7 years. It's called Safety Matters. And what we've done is we've taken three Chittenden staff and we've trained them in that program and then sent them to a training for trainers. So they are trainers in this program, and the National Institute of Corrections is coming to Vermont with their trainers this summer, and they will be training all the Chittenden staff in this training. And some of the highlights in the training are sexual safety and gender specific, effective communication skills, de-escalation skills and techniques, trauma triggers, and healthy relationships. And we really think that that's going to have a tremendous impact on the facility. And we're going to take that a step further. We're going to take some of the principles from that training and apply them to our academy. Our Corrections Academy has been 5 weeks under Commissioner Baker. We're going to add a sixth week. We're going to take a look at some of those principles and build that in, particularly around gender responsive and trauma informed. And the big piece for me is I'm really a strong advocate that we need to carry this over into the field too. I think that's a piece that really goes unnoticed. We need to apply those principles to the folks in the field that are supervising a much larger population than those incarcerated.
Bill, I'm glad you brought that up. Let's talk about what that means in the field, because I think what you're referring to is there's another 400 women in the correction system who aren't incarcerated. So tell us about them and how you see this extending to working in the field.
Yeah, I mean, when you throw out the number 400, we really have, across the state, we have a number of women under supervision in the community, but we've identified about 400 women that fall into the high-risk, high-need category. And one of the frustrations for me when I returned from the correctional facility to the field is I really found that, of course, a number of these women, we need to understand, have never been incarcerated, and that's our goal, to not incarcerate them. But women will typically, if you think about it, they go to court, they get sentenced, or they're released from jail, they show up at the probation office, they're assigned to a probation officer, and that probation officer may not have the skill set to understand the differences between men and women and some of the difficulties in transition. So one of the goals that I'm looking to do is I'm looking to have each field site establish specialized caseloads, and that is also supported by our commissioner. Very similar to now, if you are a probation officer in the community and you're working with a domestic violence caseload or a sex offender caseload, there's certain trainings and criterias that you need to go through to work with that population, and it really should be no different than women, because the challenges that the women face coming into the community are pretty significant. Just to give you an example, statistically speaking, about 71% of the women incarcerated have at least one child under the age of 18, and I think those numbers are actually higher in Vermont. 31% of those parents were single parents living with their child before they went to jail, and that population, those numbers are very different with men. Men incarcerated, that number falls down to less than 4%. So if you think about it, you're incarcerated, you're coming out into the community, and you're required to attend a number of programs. You have to work full-time. You have to attend trainings. You have curfews. You have conditions you have to follow. And then, oh, by the way, you just got released. So somebody, usually a family member, was taking care of your child, and now that you've been released, it's a handoff. So now all of a sudden, you also are expected to be a single mom under these conditions too, and it's pretty overwhelming. So I think having a skill set of really understanding and supporting that process is very important.
We only have a few minutes left, Bill. I want to make sure we talk about future plans. How do you envision a new facility to replace the one we have in South Burlington?
Well, that's certainly the several million dollar question.
Yes.
I think the big thing we need to understand is we need to build based on what our need is. You know, for example, we have 88 people incarcerated. 55 of them are sentenced, but 47 of them are eligible for release within 2 years. So the question you have to ask is, do we need a prison or do we need a solid reentry program? And I would argue that the reentry housing unit would be more important than the actual prison, because we really need to have a much cleaner handoff into the community, and I think that's something that we're really going to take a deep dive into.
If we have a new facility, it's at least 6 years into the future. What can we do in the interim, what we have there in South Burlington?
Well, we're really spending a lot of time at looking at the facility now, because you're right. I mean, it's 5 or 6 years away, so most of the women that are currently incarcerated there will never see the new facility. So we are really we hired a consultant from out of state who recently came in a couple of weeks ago, and we're going to be meeting with him later this week and really taking a deep dive into the existing facility to ensure that it's safe and adequate and appropriate for use over the next 5 years. We've done a number of things. We've did like a kitchen makeover. We've replaced we've had some doors in there with no windows. We've added the windows for security reasons. We've done a camera upgrade. There's a walking path outside for the women. Certainly fresh paint. We're looking to do some major work on the floors and so forth. So we're really trying to maximize the use of that facility and improve the overall quality for not only the women incarcerated, but for the staff that are working there.
And one other feeling I get is, to really help the women who are incarcerated, the women who are in the program, we need to attract more women to the corrections department. How do we do that, Bill?
Absolutely. Under Commissioner Baker, we are doing a major recruitment push. And I think it's just, we have some, you know, when I started this business 40 years ago, it was almost unheard of to have correctional officers working in women correctional officers working in a facility. So we slowly made some significant progress there, but we have some really, really talented women working in the Department of Corrections in the institution and in the field. And I think utilizing those talented folks in helping us in our recruitment efforts will go a long ways.
And this is a big question with about a minute left. I apologize. But are there any larger systemic changes we need to make to ensure that women in the correction system are leaving the system far better off than when they entered it?
Well, we're really making a shift in the whole transition phase, too. We're looking at developing a new risk assessment instrument, which will identify critical needs that is specific for women. It's called a Women Risk Needs Assessment. It's less generic, and I think that will help us a lot. We're really moving away from transitional housing to more supportive housing, which will bridge more permanent housing and stability. A lot of our transitional housing now have struggled with folks committing small violations and returning to jail, and that's stuff that we really want to avoid. We want to keep those folks in the program and really work towards reducing the homelessness, which ultimately will lead to recidivism. Mm-hmm. So we've done some pretty significant work there.
Bill Soule has worked for the Vermont Department of Corrections for over 40 years. Currently, he is the project manager for the DOC. Bill, thank you so much for being on the program this morning.
Thanks, Rick. I enjoyed it.
Okay. That is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is produced by Rachel Connor, Zoe Helena, and Willow Zartarian, and was directed today by Lee Cattell. Our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Feel free to suggest topics or guests, and you can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading the podcast at WDEVradio.com. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre is up next, and coming up today at 1 o'clock, Travels with Charlie, followed by a couple hours of The Getaway with Greg Hooker. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here tomorrow.